What's up, everybody? It's Austin Rivers from Off Guard, and I've got some exciting news. Off Guard, hosted by me and my guy Pasha Hagigi, is officially moving to our own podcast feed. We are now dropping two shows every week. Me and Pasha go way back and talk so much hoops already that we figured it was time to fire up the mics and let you in on these conversations. Every week, Pasha and myself will hit on the biggest stories happening around the league. Tap into the show twice a week on our new Off Guard feed on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Off the Pike, presented by FanDuel. April showers bring a loaded sports calendar, and FanDuel is the place to bet on it all. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub. Filter by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same-game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting on the Explore page and the Pulse and get paid instantly when you win. So download the app today and bet with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available and listen to the end of this episode for additional details. Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com.
Welcome into Off the Pike. I'm Brian Barrett. I hope you've all been enjoying the NCAA tournament. The madness, it has been insane. The tournament, very hard to predict. I'll say that. That's for damn sure. I felt really good about that Auburn team, and they went down in the first round. Crazy game there. I love that Illinois team, and they're actually better than I thought they were going to be. They've been unbelievable, but this tournament really has been almost impossible for the committee to screw up, right? I mean, we were complaining so much about Virginia. How did they get into the tournament? And look, it was a fair argument. There was a lot of teams that deserved to be in this tournament over Virginia, but it's just amazing now, like, that's not even a storyline because we have all these crazy games. For example, that NC State game, they beat Oakland in overtime. Oakland, of course, had the massive upset over Kentucky. John Calipari, I know it's a huge buyout. I don't know how Kentucky keeps that guy anymore. He continues to lose games that he shouldn't. But nonetheless, NC State beats Oakland in overtime. They played seven times in 12 days and won them all. I mean, remember, they had to go through the ACC tournament just to get a bid, and they're able to win that game. DJ Burns has just been awesome for them. And then you have that amazing late-night game on Saturday, Creighton and Oregon. Oh, my. That was just nuts. Somehow, you get to double overtime, and Oregon didn't actually cover the spread, which is amazing to even fathom that could be a possibility. They had a chance to win that game on multiple occasions. I mean, Cousnard was awesome for them. He actually reminds me of Donovan Mitchell a little bit. And their big man, Dante, he played 48 minutes. He had 28 and 20. And they really should have won. I mean, it's 62-58 with 34 seconds left. They missed the front side of a 1-1. They had a four-point lead with 34 seconds left. Couldn't hit free throws, unfortunately, for the Ducks. They go down to Creighton, who I had Creighton coming out of that West region. But, I mean, this has been difficult to predict, this tournament. I mean, Florida goes down in the first round. You have all these crazy upsets. And then Saturday, you have chalk. All the teams that were the higher seed win on Saturday. But it's been an amazing tournament so far. But I digress. I've just had a lot of fun over the past couple of days watching basketball all day. But we're flying solo today. And we're going to save the Bruins thoughts I have for Monday. Connor Ryan's going to join us, so we'll get into the bees with him as they've now lost back-to-back games. That was a tough one on Saturday to the Flyers, so we'll get into that with Connor. But something dawned on me today watching the Celtics over the weekend, and they are rolling right now. I'm really starting to wonder, is Joe Mazzulla now, like, underrated as a coach? Because you look at it now on FanDuel, they have it up as he's plus 1,200 to win the coach of the year. Same odds as Chris Finch of the Timberwolves. Mark Dagnall is the overwhelming favorite right now. He is at minus 450. And then you have Jamal Mosley, who's plus 650, who certainly deserves to be part of this conversation considering what Orlando's doing. But I just point that out. So, okay, the books say that he's the third favorite, if you will, to win the coach of the year. But you think about this team, and we talk about so many different players, and deservingly so, but we haven't really brought up the coach, who's actually improved tremendously this season. you watch how the team plays, and I think it's a really interesting discussion where I think a lot of people in the fan base and a lot of talking heads were questioning Joe Mazzulla entering the season. We talked about the timeouts a ton last year, right? That became a huge talking point. And then this whole idea of they're too three-point reliant. We've had that conversation time and time again. And it's interesting to me because another conversation we always have is, can they get good shots late in games? Which I think he can only prove that when they get into the postseason, right? Because, yeah, there are certain games where this has flared up to be an issue, but it's such a small sample size of the season, right? You're saying, yes, if they get in a close game in this specific postseason series, is this a concern? Yes, but you also look at it and you say, hey, they may blow out a bunch of teams in a series where three of the four wins, they win by double digits just because of how this team has played throughout the season. So some of these questions that we have, he can't answer them until we get into the postseason. But if you look at what he's done in the regular season so far, there's no doubt he's a significantly better coach this year than he was a season ago. And it's almost like the expectations for Mazzulla are almost unfair, right? It's championship or bust. And look, with the roster, I get it. It makes sense. But you think about this, the experience level for Mazzulla right now. You think about the mainstays for the Celtics with Tatum and Jaylen Brown. They have been in the playoffs every year of their careers. Last year, Mazzulla came in after not even being a lead assistant. In fact, he was sitting, remember, behind the bench, and he's coaching against Eric Spoelstra, who is regarded as the best coach in the NBA right now, and Doc Rivers, who, I get it, say what you want about Doc in the playoffs, but this is an NBA champion as a coach, right? And he's well-respected around the league, right? I know he has his shortcomings in the postseason, but this is a guy that is continuing to get job after job after job, just left TV, as we all know, to go to the Milwaukee Bucks. So, and look, this is not me retroactively going back and defending Joe Mazzulla. I was critical of some of his lineup choices in the postseason last year that I disliked, and we don't need to go back and relitigate all those, but you also think about it from his staff's perspective, right? Where last year, it's guys that came to the Celtics organization with Ime to work with Ime. And then all of a sudden, Joe Mazzulla is the head coach, a guy that was sitting behind a lot of these guys on the bench the prior season, and now he's in charge of the coaching staff. It was just a weird dynamic. And this isn't defending Mazzulla. I'm just pointing out all the things that we're looking at right now, because we talk about Tatum being bad in the finals against the Warriors, Jaylen having all those turnovers last year in Game 7 against Miami. Those guys were, look, Jaylen is in his prime now and was in his prime last year, but a lot of those issues they've had in the postseason before, last year notwithstanding, it's when they're young players, right? Especially when you look at it from the perspective of Jason Tatum in that series against the Warriors, right? Last year was Joe's first experience as a head coach in the NBA playoffs. And he's learned from that, and he's a better coach, right? And we saw his vision last year, at least how he wanted to play. And now with guys like Sam Cassell and Charles Lee, who understand Mazzulla's vision and have helped Mazzulla and added different elements to his vision, right? Things are only getting better. See, because if you look at it right now, this is the time in the season when you're running away with the East. You are 11 and a half games, as we're recording here on Sunday afternoon, ahead of the Bucks in the Eastern Conference. The Celtics could easily be coasting right now. You look at it, Tatum and Jaylen are basically switching off which games they play in the past week or so outside of the Milwaukee game, right? Where it's one night, Jaylen's not going to play one night, it's Tatum's not going to play. Drew right now is dealing with this dead arm situation, which is a bit concerning that he's got a dead arm. Haven't really heard that much from a basketball player, but he heard it when he hit a screener the other night. So hopefully that's something that they'll fix. I mean, it doesn't seem like they're too concerned about it, but not that they'll fix it, but that it'll get fixed and ironed out. It's a little bit concerning. But then you think about it, Kristaps and Al are basically alternating games too, and they still keep winning. And I get it. They're not playing good teams, but they're blowing out these teams. I get it. Detroit's not good. You win that game easily. 129-102. Then you crush Chicago. No, you don't crush Chicago. You battle Chicago on that game on Saturday night. 124-113. And this is sort of reminding me of what the Patriots used to do back in the day to teams, where it's just like, and I'm not saying that Hauser is Jaylen when Jaylen isn't out there, or Pritchard is Drew when Drew isn't out there, right? But these guys are playing at a ridiculously high level when you give the starters the night off, right? It's that next man up mentality. And the team playing to that standard where every night they're bringing it, and anybody who plays is playing up to that standard, the coach deserves credit for that, right? And we can say, look, they have good leadership. But whoever said that about the Celtics before the season? We never talked about this being a good team in terms of the leadership. In fact, we've questioned that in the past. That has never been a thing with this team. Now, look, I do believe, and this is not meant to be a whole thing about criticizing Marcus Smart, I do believe that getting Smart out of the room enabled Tatum to be more of a leader, Mazzulla to have the voice of the team, like when he needs to address the team, it's not Marcus all the time, and Jalen has obviously become the leader on the team in terms of the player thing. Tatum's obviously taking a bigger role, but Jalen's the guy, right? And you look at sort of how Jalen plays defensively, that intensity he's bringing, it's different than any other year in his career. Jalen said before the season, at different points in my career, I've been able to display my defensive ability, but not enough. I think when I'm dialed in and make sure I'm challenging myself, I think I could be one of the better defenders in the world. His defense this year, hey, I'm going to take on the Steph matchup. I'm going to take on the Luka matchup. That's leadership from Jalen. And part of that is from the coach. This is a mentality thing where Mazzulla said before the season, defense is what gets you in the door. Defense is the admission ticket. You have to do it. You don't really have a choice. That's how I can get better as a coach. He said he needs to be better with this team defensively. And part of the issue with the Celtics last year in the postseason, their defense slipped at times where they had a defensive rating of 120 or worse 8 times last year. 8 times in the postseason. They were 1-7 in those games. They also had a defensive rating better than 109.7 last postseason. And the reason I point out 109.7 is because the NBA leader last year in defense was the Cavs right around that area. They did that on, what, 7 occasions last year where they were better than the best defense in the league. So they could play to that standard, but they didn't always bring it. They didn't always play to that standard, right? That was the issue that you had with the Celtics at times last season. That's why Mazzulla emphasized this before the season, and that trickled down to the leader of the team in Jaylen Brown. So like we talk about all the time with coaches, like the X's and O's and all this, but sometimes it's about that part of the equation too. The fact that this team plays to that standard every year, or every night, I should say, not every year, they're bringing it every night this year, the coach does deserve a lot of credit for that because a lot of teams will step off the gas when they have a lead like this or like a back-to-back against Chicago. And I know Chicago's not a good team, but it's a back-to-back. Chicago's clearly up for that game on Saturday night, and the Celtics still find a way to win when they're sitting a bunch of guys, okay? This year, there's more of a standard where you don't have those bad losses. We've referenced the number before, 24-1 against teams in the bottom 10 in point differential. And they have a plus 19.1 net rating, meaning they're outscoring teams by almost 20 points per 100 possessions in those games. It's not even close. Last year, they had a good record, but it was 20-8 compared to 24-1. They don't have the bad losses. They have the one Charlotte game. Outside of that, they don't have the bad losses against bad teams. Like last year when the Thunder weren't great yet. Remember they had that awful loss to the Thunder. They had the Rockets loss. They had so many bad losses last season. They lost to the Magic a bunch of times, and the Magic were not the Magic yet. So it just this year, it doesn't matter who's playing for this team. Now, ultimately, it does in the postseason. Don't get confused with what I'm saying. But right now, it doesn't matter who's playing every night. They're going to play to the same standard. And we'll see, like a lot of this, as we all know, has to be mentioned like when they get to the postseason. So I understand that. But I think we have to look at how this team is improving from last year to this year. And a lot of it is the consistency. Sure, the talent is way better. We all acknowledge that. But the effort level is much better this season than it was a year ago. This team is improving. Post All-Star break, that they're better than they were pre-All-Star break. They're 14-2 since the All-Star break. A 128.4 offensive rating, which is by far the best in the NBA. If you look at it compared to everybody else, it's not even close, right? And then you look at them pre-All-Star break, they had the best offense in the NBA, but it was a 120.8, which is a great number, but they're, what, 7.6 points per 100, better post-All-Star break than they were pre-All-Star break. And these numbers should be down because all these officiating changes, right? Where they're calling less fouls, right? Like this has been documented in the NBA. It should be more difficult to score, and the Celtics have been better post-All-Star break. You look at their net rating, they're outscoring teams post-All-Star break by 18.2 points per 100. Obviously, first in the NBA. Second is the Thunder at 9.6. The gap between the Celtics and the Thunder is wider than the gap between the Thunder and the Warriors, and the Warriors are 15th in net rating. 15th! The gap between 2 and 15 is wider than the gap, or the gap between 1 and 2 is wider than the gap between 2 and 15. It's just insane what they're doing. And the thing we're seeing right now is with Jaylen and Tatum taking these games off and Drew dealing with this dead arm situation that I alluded to, the role guys are getting better. And I think this only helps you when you get into the postseason that all these role players for the Celtics are getting a bunch of opportunities. And the results are you're still winning when these guys are getting the big time minutes on a nightly basis, a weekly basis now because of the injuries to these guys. And that too is part of the standard that the coach has put in place for the team, right? And that is part of coaching. It's not just, hey, we're going to run this play. We're going to do this. This is our strategy. We're going to win the math game. We're going to win on the margins like Joe Mazzulla always says. This is part of it too. And I go to the Chicago game. No Jaylen. Okay, Hauser goes for 23. He had 7 threes in that game, okay? Oh, no Porzingis. Al goes for 23. He had 5 threes. Oh, no Drew. Pritchard's going to dish out 8 assists and he's going to have 15 points. The Detroit game, and I get it's Detroit. Jaylen dominated that game. He had, what, 33? But then you don't have Tatum, so you get 20 from Pritchard, your second leading scorer, to go along with 19 from Derek White and Kristaps Porzingis. And then you think about it with Pritchard individually. Last 5 games, he's playing 35.2 minutes, 18.2 points, 50% from the field, 48.6% on threes, and it's 37 threes. So it's not like a small amount of threes in that 5-game span. 8 assists, 3.6 rebounds. He's legit like playing like an elite guard during that stretch. And I'm not saying he is. Like, don't get confused with what I'm saying. I'm just saying he's living up to what the Celtics want from their backcourt, right? Do what is asked of you. Pritchard is thriving right now. You look at on the season. Think about these numbers. When he plays between 30 and 39 minutes, 10 games this year, 18.3 points, 52.8% from the field, 48% from three, 5.7 assists, 3.9 rebounds. And remember, 5 games recently he's done that and another 5 games on the season. So every time he gets between 30 and 39 minutes, he's putting up really good numbers. By the way, before I go forward with this, where I'm giving Mazzulla a lot of credit, but also these role players, this is such a good contract by Brad Stevens. Like when that extension came out, I loved it because it was not a lot of money. But you look at it right now. Drew is going to be up for an extension, as we all know. Derek White is going to get a massive payday. And I would assume that's with the Celtics, but he's getting a massive payday. You need these type of contracts. Like, if you look at Pritchard's deal, it's 4 for 30, okay, through 27-28. And it's at what that's 7.5 per year. You look at around the league, and I'm not saying Pritchard is better than all these guys. I'm just pointing out, like, Terry Rozier makes 23 mil, okay? He's a better player than Pritchard, but Pritchard is perfect for the team. I'm just pointing out the salaries here. Brogdon's at 22.5. Markel Fultz, who's always dealing with injuries, is at 17. Gabe Vincent, who's been dealing with an injury all season long, and he got this contract because of what he did in the playoffs, he's at 10.5. TJ McConnell's at 8.7. So you get the point. It's like, this is a very valuable contract for a third guard. That is a genius move by Brad Stevens. So we've talked about it all season long, like the niche he has as an offensive rebounder, where the Celtics' offensive rebounding percentage goes up almost 9 percentage points when he's on the floor. That's in the 99th percentile via cleaning the glass. He impacts the offensive glass in an insane way. It's not just like an outlier number or a weird number. You actually see him going after the offensive rebounds. Another thing they do with Pritchard is they're way better off live rebounds, right? So when they get the defensive rebound, when Pritchard's on the court, the Celtics have a 129.7 offensive rating. That's in the 80th percentile via cleaning the glass. And it increases by 9.7 points per 100. That's in the 77th percentile because if he gets a rebound or if he gets the outlet, he is just pushing the ball and you're getting a quick shot on the other end. We see it. It happens all the time. I've also noticed one thing with Pritchard is he does this thing where Steve Nash really made this popular. And again, I'm not comparing the players. I'm just saying Steve Nash made this popular where he'll basically dribble underneath the basket, like, and he'll find somebody that like cuts or something along those lines. Or a lot of times he'll find somebody in the opposite corner. It's a really nice thing that he does because it feels like he always creates a good shot from it. And I just thought in that game on Saturday night against Chicago, the energy level was off the charts. He had a 3-possession stretch where he hit a 3, then he penetrated, kicked it out for a corner 3, and then he had a hit-ahead pass for Tatum for an and-one. This is part of what I'm talking about, like, after a live rebound. He gets the rebound, hit-ahead, Tatum gets an and-one. It just, he's 100 miles an hour all the time, and I think sometimes what you need is the type of guy that changes the dynamic of the game, that changes the energy. Pritchard certainly does that when he checks into these games. Offense right now with Pritchard on the court, 4.3 points per 100 better. That's in the 83rd percentile via cleaning the glass. And you can say, yeah, all the Celtics are great when it comes to playing on this team. Yeah, but Pritchard, the offense actually gets better when he's on the court, right? So look, there are going to be certain matchups in the postseason that you're going to be worried about with Pritchard, right? Where it's like, oh, are they going to hunt him defensively because he's smaller? Like the Jimmy Butler situation in game one of the Eastern Conference Finals last year. There's going to be moments like that. But he is going to play a major factor in a postseason series and swing a game or two with the energy that he brings, because he's not just a one-dimensional player. He's actually a really good defensive player when we're talking about just putting ball pressure on opponents' guards. He's guarding guys like on the other side of the court, right? Like after rebounds or after inbound passes, he's playing these guys the entire court. Like he's definitely a valuable defensive player. Just certain matchups he's not going to be great in, obviously. But I think he's done an outstanding job for this team this year. And again, I do give the coach partial credit for this because he's instilled the confidence in him where Pritchard knows he's going to get X amount of minutes every night now. And he's under contract. So that's part of coaching, and give Pritchard credit as well. The other guy is Hauser. So last six games, he's hit 33 threes, 33 of 58. So almost 57%. The 33 threes during that stretch are the most in the NBA. Grayson Allen and Jalen Green are second at 29. Hauser in the last six games has hit 33. If you look at what Hauser is providing this team right now, it's so critical to what the Celtics want to do. He entered Sunday 10th in made catch and shoot threes in the NBA at 141, and he's 42.3% on those attempts. If you just take the month of March, he's at 35, the second most, and he's shooting 51.5%. Grayson Allen's the only guy that's hit more catch and shoot threes in the month of March, okay? So it's just important because if you look at what he provides, the spacing is awesome, right? And what happens is these driving lanes open up, right? Because a lot of the guys on the Celtics can beat you off the dribble, especially if it's a pick and roll situation. The defense is going to be put in a bind to begin with. And if Hauser's the guy on the wing, the slot, or in the corner, you have to make a decision. Are you going to sort of move away from Hauser? Are you helping? Are you letting the drive? Are you letting the lob? Like, you have to make a decision when he's on the court. And this team, we all know they take a ton of threes. We've documented that. But it goes way up when he's on the court. It goes up by 5.9 percentage points, the amount of shots they take from three-point territory. 47.3% of their shots from deep when he's on the court. That's in the 100th percentile via cleaning the glass. And as I mentioned, it's up 5.9 percentage points. That's in the 96th percentile. So that pick and roll game, when guys are going ISO, well, there's going to be a guy in Hauser that's just sitting out there if somebody comes off to help in an isolation situation. And then you look at the defense, they're actually 2.4 points per 100 better with him on the floor, 72nd percentile. So he holds up defensively. I'm not telling you he's the best isolation defender in the NBA, but he's not like an easy guy to take advantage of because he's 6'8". It's much easier to take advantage of smaller defenders. Hauser, yeah, there's a lot of times where it's like, okay, teams are going after Hauser because it's a choice. Think about who else is on the court with him most of the time. It's like, okay, Derek White's out there, Jason Tatum's out there, Drew Holiday's out there. Like, who are you going to go after? It's like, yes, he's the worst defender in most of the lineups he's in, but it's only because he's playing with elite defensive players, right? He's 6'8". I mean, he's not a small guy. And so then you think about it too. It's just, I believe that right now, I look at what Pritchard can bring from an energy standpoint in the playoffs, the offensive rebounding, pushing the ball in transition, hitting critical shots. And then you look at what Hauser does with his shooting. He too is going to turn a game. And again, this is a guy that I give credit to where I look back at Missoula and say he deserves credit for this because of the fact that Hauser said now he knows like where his minutes are coming from. And just like I talk about, hey, Marcus isn't here anymore. We've seen improvement from Derek White just by getting more playing time, right? He's taken the most threes he's ever taken in his career per game. He's shooting at a high level, over 39%. He's getting opportunities. He's closing out games because Marcus is not here. Well, if you look at Grant Williams, that was sort of a decision at times last year. Do we go with Grant? Do we go with Sam Hauser? And now that decision has been made for Joe where it's like, yes, you're going with Hauser because he's the option and he's gained confidence from that, right? So I just think that's a huge thing too, is that those two guys are not in the building anymore. And this is now, like, Missoula, there's not going to be pushback from a lot of guys on the team. There's not. Like, these guys are all in on what Missoula is doing now. The two guys that sort of could give you trouble, if you will, were Grant and Marcus. They're no longer in the building. And I think another thing that I've been thinking about, if you look now going forward here, two teams that you consider to be your biggest competition, the Denver Nuggets and the Milwaukee Bucks, who, of course, the Celtics let the Bucks back in that game. We talked about that on, what, the Thursday pod. But if you look at this, so one of the things we found out in the Denver game, they don't want to put Jokic on Porzingis. They did that at the beginning of the game. Remember, and Porzingis was getting open looks, and Jokic is having to go out there. So they switched him. Remember, at the end of the game, they put him on Drew. And Drew hit a couple of threes late in that game. So that's something that is going to be interesting if the Celtics get to the finals, knock on wood, or the Nuggets get to the finals. Actually, I don't want the Nuggets to get in the finals, so maybe I don't knock on wood here. But anyway, I don't want to get too caught up in that. But this is something where if you think about, well, how do you beat the Nuggets? They're going to out-execute pretty much every team of the NBA. The Celtics will beat the Nuggets if they get to the finals in games, right? That they just, their three-point numbers are just through the roof. The Nuggets are not a high-volume three-point team. There's going to be games the Celtics win in that series because they get so hot from three-point territory. But when we're talking about the close games and we're talking about the length of a series, if the Celtics get there, you have to make Jokic work on defense. And if they're not going to put him on Porzingis, you get Drew more involved offensively like you saw at the end of that game against Denver. So I think that's just something to keep in the back of your head. If you're looking at, okay, yeah, I know we're both or we're all aggravated with the way the Celtics lost those two games, or they couldn't come up with the critical shots late in those games, and Tatum was bad in both those games against Denver. I mean, more so in the second one than the first one. The first one, he rushed the shot. But you get the point. It's just there are going to be buttons that the Celtics can press in that series. And I think if you're looking at that, I know it's tough to look at that and say, oh, yeah, there's nothing good that came out of that game. I think there is some stuff that you can look at and say, hey, that is good that they figured this one out. The other thing with the Bucks is we didn't see Giannis, okay, in that game last Wednesday. I think I said Thursday, last Wednesday. So that's obviously a totally different dynamic when he's in there. But Doc did go to that zone, okay, and the Celtics really struggle with it until late where Tatum's like, okay, if Malik Beasley's at the top of the zone, I'm going to attack Beasley. But if you get into a postseason series now against the Bucks, and I didn't even think it was a good zone. I just think it caught the Celtics off guard. Now they know, like, okay, scouting report, when we get ready for the series, this is what we're doing. When we see the zone, this is our game plan, right? So those things, like, there's certain things, and the Celtics are a better team than the Bucks. I'm not going to say the same thing about Denver, because I know statistically they are, but Denver's the champs. They have the best player in the NBA and all that. They have a ton of advantages against Milwaukee, but I do think you learn some of these things in these playoff or in these regular season games against the two teams that you consider to be your biggest competition. I did have another playoff thought too. So when you look at the bracket, how it's currently set up, we're recording this is 2:30 on Sunday afternoon. The Heat right now have the 7th spot. They actually have not been playing well lately, but Philly has the 8th spot. I know they say Embiid's doing all this stuff to come back. Are you really bringing him back at this point, where he's a guy that's dealt with injuries his entire career? The chances of you making a run at this point based on where you are in the bracket are very small. And I know they keep saying, like Nick Nurse alluded to it the other day, I just don't see it. I don't think the juice is worth the squeeze there. So I'm going to say that Miami, and look, it's a one game thing, so who knows? Like, Miami lost to Atlanta last year, remember, in the play-in situation. But I do think when you look at it as Celtics fans, we obviously want Miami to win. So Miami doesn't play the Celtics. We want them to play the number 2 seed, the Bucks, okay? So let's assume that happens for the sake of this hypothetical here. Then in all likelihood, that would put the Bucks in a series against the Heat. And the Heat have beaten the Bucks. They just beat them, just like they just beat the Celtics, right? And I know both teams are different and all that, blah, blah, blah. But you would like that from a Celtics perspective. It's like, oh, who we think is the biggest competitor to the Celtics, the two teams we think of. And look, there's better teams in the East than Miami, but it's just from a playoff perspective, we get scared of Miami because who Miami is, what Miami has done to the Celtics in the playoffs before. I'm not trying to disrespect Orlando and the Knicks. I'll get to them in a second here. But the reason I bring that up is just that could be a dogfight if you're the Celtics. And then the Celtics would get the winner of what? The rest of those games where it's like, okay, you have the winner of then Chicago and Atlanta, and then the loser of the Philly thing, or Philly losing to one of those teams, and we'll see, like, the whole Embiid situation, right? Like, if it's not Philly, Atlanta, Chicago, and look, DeRozan did his thing again. I mean, DeRozan always plays well against the Celtics. I think a lot of it is, I mean, this is going back to the Brad Stevens era. They give up mid-range jumpers. Like, they'll let you take those shots. They don't want you to take threes, right? And he had 28 in that game Saturday, but that's a team where I look at the Bulls and I say, if that's the 8 seed, say if Chicago gets the 8 seed, and they play tough. Like, I give that Bulls team credit. Like, obviously the organization is a dumpster fire, but they play hard. Like, they have not quit on the season. But you look at it. So they shot in that game on Saturday, 57.3% from the field. The Celtics won by 11. They shot 57% and they lost by 11 because the Celtics hit 21 threes. The Bulls hit 9. So they outscored them by 36 points at the three-point line. So this is the thing. The margin of error for the Celtics in that matchup is so wide because the Bulls only hit 11.6 threes per game, 26. So the Celtics are going to have an easy series if it's the Bulls that are the 8th seed. And as I said, if it's Philly, I don't believe that Embiid's going to be there. If it is Embiid, it's going to be a hobbled version of himself, and the Celtics will wear him out if he plays. They're just going to put him in every single action. And then you look at Atlanta. Atlanta is 26 in defense. If that's a team, and I know last year it's like, okay, Atlanta, that was way more than the Celtics bargained for in that particular series. They're clearly more mature and more dialed in than they were last year compared to this year. You can just tell by the way they treat these regular season games. Back-to-back in Chicago could have easily lost that game. So that to me is like this bracket is just setting up perfectly for the Celtics where you look at it and you say, okay, if Milwaukee gets the Heat, okay, you go through that battle. And then we'll see what happens. 3-4-5 is jumbled up now because Cleveland's now dealing with a tough situation. Donovan Mitchell, we talked about the fact that he has the nose situation where he broke his nose. Brian Windhorst said, or I don't know if it's a break. They said he's reevaluated in a week. Brian Windhorst said on his podcast that essentially they're going to keep him out longer, not because of the nose, the face situation, whatever it is, but because the knee, because the PRP injection like essentially didn't work. So he's still dealing with that knee situation right now. So then when you look at it from that perspective, the Celtics, whoever it is, whether it's going to be Cleveland, New York, Orlando, depending on how the 3-4-5 goes, those series are going to be bloodbaths. Any of those teams that play against each other. I mean, especially if it's Orlando and Cleveland, those are two big, Orlando and the Knicks, those are physical teams. I mean, I guess you could say the same thing about the Cavaliers if they get their guys there. But the reason I say all this is, okay, your second round series is going to be against a team that went through a war. And then eventually, if the Bucks get to you in the conference finals, they're going to be going through wars too. And I just look at the Celtics team where it's like, okay, yes, Orlando has given them trouble in the past, but then they blew them out those two games, right? So I just look at how this Eastern Conference is lining up for the Celtics. And the thing that I have to keep thinking about, we keep talking about, hey, we have to wait to the postseason to see, can they make the critical plays late in games? And all that is certainly fair. I think another thing that we need to learn about the Celtics is, are they just going to have this killer instinct where they are going to destroy you early on in the postseason? Atlanta went 6. Philly went 7. You should have never fallen behind 3-0 to the Miami Heat 2 years ago. You go 7 against the Milwaukee Bucks. Like, those series went way too long for the Celtics. That's what I think is another thing we will learn in the postseason. If I'm looking at what they're doing in the regular season and the way they're treating the regular season, they're trying to stay sharp. You can tell, and I don't know for a fact if that's part of it, is they're like, hey, we can't be going through these marathons because by the time we get to these series, like the finals against the Warriors, and this is not defending them because they put themselves in this position, they completely ran out of gas. That cannot repeat itself, okay? That cannot happen again. And I think you look at the bracket, they should have an easy run. And if we're looking at the team out west, Denver is going to have a more difficult run to get there than the Celtics. All right. A lot more to get into. I do want to get to a couple of Red Sox notes as we creep closer to opening day. Say goodbye to busted brackets because FanDuel lets you bet on every game of the tourney. Whether you're betting on a big upset or a one seed, it's time to go dancing on America's number one sportsbook. Right now, new customers get $200 in bonus bets if your first $5 bet wins. So I'm looking at the East Regional. I like Illinois to cover 2.5 against Iowa State. It should be a really good game. It's a great matchup, but that Illinois team can really fill it up. 85 points in the first round, 89 in the second round. So I'll take the Illini to cover 2.5 against the Cyclones. That's $200 to use on point spreads, money lines. You can even pick who's going to win it all. And the wait is over, North Carolina. FanDuel is officially live in the Tar Heel State. Just visit FanDuel.com/pike and bet on college hoops until they cut down the nets. Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit theringer.com/RG. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Welcome back into Off the Pike. So it's crazy, man. Opening day on Thursday with the NCAA tournament. We got college basketball. It's a great time of the year. So I don't like the fact that opening day, and look, this is not like that Major League Baseball is catering to the Red Sox, but I don't like the fact that the first game of the season for the Red Sox is at 10:10 in Seattle, okay? Call me crazy. Not the biggest fan of the game being that late. in Seattle. I mean, I'm going to watch either way, but I feel bad for the average person that works a 9-to-5 that wants to watch the game and it's on a 10-10. I mean, come on. Ridiculous. And look, I get it. It's Seattle's team, but why is opening day for the Mariners a night game? Most teams like to have a little day game. The Red Sox always have that little Thursday day game. A lot of times it ends up being Friday because of the weather. But anyway, that pisses me off. I don't know. Selfishly, I guess. But anyway, so Michael Lorenzen signed a 1-year, $4.5 million deal with the Texas Rangers. And the reason I bring this up is he made the All-Star team last year. Now, I will say this, after he got traded from Detroit to Philadelphia, it was not good for Philly. And I'm not saying this is a big deal that you didn't sign Lorenzen, like in a vacuum. He's a 4.11 career ERA guy, 1.33 whip, 4.32 FIP. But it's the fact that last year, he threw 153 innings. And he doesn't have a ton of mileage on him either. But just the fact, okay, that's something that the Red Sox really valued in the offseason. Breslow pointed it out when they signed Lucas Giolito because they didn't know if the rest of the guys are going to give them length. That's part of the intrigue with Giolito for them. Obviously, it's not going to happen now with the elbow situation. But anyway, so there are two concerns to me with this. So first of all, the Sox announced that the rotation, no surprise, on Saturday. Alex Cora announced that Houck and Whitlock are in there. Obviously, we knew the top three, Pivetta, Bayo, and Crawford. I guess Bayo, because he's starting open today, Pivetta and Crawford. So, first, let's get to this. Alex Speer has an article up at the Globe right now talking about Lorenzen headed to the Rangers and why the Red Sox really weren't in on this. One agent joked, quote, "The ATM is closed." Okay. So, yes, this is one agent. This is his perception of the Red Sox right now. I get it, it's one agent. But this is the perception, right? This isn't just one agent. Like, if it's just one agent joking around, Speer doesn't just put this in a story. It's like, this is what he's been hearing throughout the spring training process, so to speak, right? So if you look at it, it's $4.5 million for a guy that can give you 150 innings when you have a bunch of questions about your rotation. That, and we've been talking about it all offseason, that the perception is the Red Sox are not spending. So when you hear something like this as a Red Sox fan, it just sort of aggravates you, right? Where it's like, that's all it was for Michael Lorenzen? You didn't want to take a shot on Michael Lorenzen? But anyway, so the other thing I'll say is this. The thing that's more interesting to me is Alex Speer had the note in the article that the Sox are excited about giving Garrett Whitlock and Tanner Houck a chance to prove they can be big league starters following healthy offseasons. They're both healthy, right? So both have had really good springs, and we talked about that with Ann Kundle last week if you missed that pod. And if you look at the contracts, the Red Sox, they have Whitlock signed through 2026. And then they have two club option years at 27 and 28. So he makes 3.3 this year. It goes to 5.3, 7.3, 8.3, 10.5 in the option years. So if Whitlock is a starter for this organization going forward, this is a bargain contract, okay? Now, Tanner Houck is still pre-arb, right? I mean, seriously, he's still pre-arb. You think about it. I feel like Tanner Houck's been here forever, but he's still pre-arb. First year of arbitration, 2025. Then you have 2 years after that. So you still have this year and three more years of control over the player. So here's the thing. If these guys are starters, this is a massive advantage for the Red Sox, right? If they actually are legitimate starters, not even like great starters, just, hey, you can trust him every 5 days. This is a major financial win for the Red Sox, and it allows you going forward to be more flexible financially. We'll see if the Red Sox actually do that based on recent years. You get the point here. But Houck's entering his 28-year-old season, and Whitlock's entering his 28-year-old season as well. So it's not like we have a lot to go off to say, hey, we trust that this is going to, like, oh yeah, this is going to happen with Houck and Whitlock, right? We talked about that with Ann as well. But Breslow had this to say, which I thought was interesting. This is from Speer's article as well. Not to put too much into spring training statistics, but guys are pitching differently. They're using different pitches. They're landing secondaries. They are leveraging strengths. All of those things are happening, and it does seem to indicate there is a meaningful step forward in front for those guys. Okay. Now, we know that Whitlock's been using a sweeper more, different type of slider. So, and Alex Cora mentioned right at the beginning of spring training that Houck's velocity's up. Okay, so these are all good things that we're hearing. Now, I have my doubts before I've mentioned about Houck, and Whitlock is more health than anything else. But after reading that quote about Breslow talking about the stuff for both Tanner and Whitlock, it made me think about Breslow in general here, where he has so much to gain and so little to lose in year one. So first off, think about this. Nobody is blaming him for the lack of spending. Because even that quote from an agent is, the ATM's off. That's not Breslow's responsibility. That's the owner, right? Where he says the ATM's off. That's not saying, hey, Breslow doesn't want to spend it. That's essentially saying the ownership group doesn't want to spend it. So he's not going to get blamed for the lack of spending, because the same thing just transpired with Chaim Bloom. There was this perceived lack of spending at times, and I don't even think it's a perception, right? And so it happened with Chaim. We're not going to blame Breslow for the same thing. Remember, Sox ownership, mainly Sam Kennedy as the mouthpiece, he said that the resources were used incorrectly last year. And now it's, hey, this is what we're going to be at in terms of financial number. So my point is, if this team stinks, the anger will not be directed at Craig Breslow. The anger is going to be directed at the ownership because of their lackluster offseason after lying and saying all this stuff about full throttle. Now, you could argue that Craig Breslow, part of his job, and this is technically part of his job, is to convince ownership when to spend. Dave Dombrowski was always able to do that, right? Chaim Bloom, less so. And look, I get it. The organization is in a different spot now than it was with Dombrowski. It's even in a different spot now than it was when Chaim was here. And same thing comparing when Chaim was here compared to Dave Dombrowski. I get all that. But if you want to critique Breslow, that would be it. But I do think as a first-time GM, it's probably a lot more difficult for him to do that than Dave Dombrowski, who had previously won a World Series with the Marlins and taken Detroit to the World Series. So that is part of it. But I don't believe that he'll get any criticism for the financial stuff. The lack of offseason splashes, that's going to go in the ownership group. But hearing what he said about the guy's stuff being better and the secondary stuff, so that's why I say, like, first of all, let me circle back to that. That's why I say there is very little to lose for Breslow and so much to gain, because if the team stinks, it's not going to be his fault. It's going to be ownership. That's what the fan base is going to think. And then when you think about what he was saying about the secondary stuff with Houck and Whitlock, and you think about Breslow's whole background is pitching, right? When he got hired, we talked about all the guys in the Cubs system, how all their stuff ticked up, the velocity, blah, blah, blah. And we're already hearing that with guys on the Red Sox. And Breslow talking about Whitlock and Houck stuff improving sort of makes sense for what he's known for, right? And we're hearing Bayo say the right things, right? And there is a case that if you look at this rotation, there's a case that all the guys are better this year. I'm not saying it's definitely going to happen. I'm just saying, okay, Pivetta, after developing the sweeper, was like legitimately one of the best pitchers in baseball for a few months. Like, he was downright dominant for a stretch. Bayo, entering year two, says he's in better shape. He's going to have more endurance down the stretch of the season. Argument that he's going to be better in year two. I would expect that, in fact. Crawford was very impressive last year, going back and forth between roles. Now he knows what he is. He's penciled in to be a starter every fifth day. There's an argument he could be better. Houck's never been consistent, so there's definitely an argument he could be better. He's never had this great season. And then Whitlock hasn't been the same guy since 2021. So if he's better than he was the past two seasons, not quite what he was in 2021 as a reliever, as a starter, you're going to feel like, okay, that's pretty good. And if these things happen, who gets the credit? It's going to be Andrew Bailey to an extent, but it's going to be Craig Breslow, because we've all heard about implementing this pitching program within the organization. He's supposed to be this pitching wizard, right? So in a weird way, Breslow's in a good spot where he'll get none of the blame and he's going to get all of the praise if it actually works out from a pitching department standpoint, right? I do think this is bizarre. So I just thought that was funny. When I was reading those comments from about Houck and Whitlock, I'm like, okay, this is sort of like what he was brought here to do. If it actually happens, he's going to get so much credit for this. But anyway, so I do think it's weird. And not that we didn't see this coming because of who was on the roster. I can't remember the Red Sox ever having, and maybe I'm just missing a year, but it's crazy to see like the lack of lefties in the rotation, right? Where it's five righties in the rotation. There's been a lot of years where it's been, they had a ton of lefties a couple of times, right? Like, I mean, obviously they had Sale and they've had David Price. They had Paxton recently. It is interesting to see all the righties in the rotation. So that's a fascinating thing to me, but we'll see what happens in terms of the rotation. But I did want to mention that briefly about Breslow. The one other thing I wanted to mention is, so earlier this offseason, Raffy called out ownership, essentially called out ownership, and maybe front office too. I don't know exactly, but he said that everybody knows what we need. He was talking about starting pitching. So my thing with Raffy is, I think he can be, if the Red Sox like are actually competitive, he could have like be at least in the MVP conversation if the Red Sox play well. He's plus 2,200 right now on FanDuel. And the reason I say that is they need Raffy to play at an MVP level. Now, I don't know if he'll ever play at an MVP level, of course, in the field. He never will. I mean, we talked about
just be decent defensively. Just don't be making a million errors, the most errors of any non-shortstop. But if you look at Devers from 19 to 23, 459 RBIs tied for fourth, 141 bombs, eighth, 287 average, 19th, 525 slug, 14th, 877 OPS, 13th, 748 hits tied for fourth, 182 doubles, second, 1,033 hard hit balls, that's balls off the bat, 95 plus miles an hour, second most in Major League Baseball during that stretch. He's entering his 27-year-old season, I should say. He's in his prime right now. And if you just look at those numbers, it's almost like he can sort of go underappreciated because the team, really, since 2018, Raffy comes up in, 2017, 2018, he's a major part of that team that won the World Series, hits the home run off Verlander. 2019 is his real breakout season where he led Major League Baseball in doubles. But from 2019 through 2023, the Red Sox have been bad. They've had one good year, and that was 2021, when he was the guy that everybody feared in the postseason from a Red Sox perspective. They didn't fear JD. They were fearing, and they didn't fear Bogarts. They feared Rafael Devers that season. But during the stretch, like, you think about the great Red Sox players, they've always been, in recent history, they've always been on good teams, competing at a high level. And I do like the fact that Rafael Devers made that comment, because it's kind of like, well, this is not what I signed up for. I signed up to be a competitive player. Like, I want to compete at the highest level. The same thing could be said about the manager. He wants to compete, right? So when you just think about it from Devers' perspective, he needs to be the guy that is leading this team offensively. And being a guy that's like, okay, I'm going to hit 30-plus home runs. I'm going to hit 50-plus doubles. I'm going to have an OPS over 900. I'm going to do everything I possibly can to carry this offense, okay? Because what I want is what we haven't gotten the past couple of years. I want help at the trading deadline, right? I want us to put the team in a position, to put ownership, to put the front office in a position where they need to make a move. We need to stay competitive to that point where we can at least have an argument that, hey, give us a chance to win. And I know that sounds crazy to think about, but I do think this. You look at all the teams in town right now, and you think about every team has a guy. Like, Tatum's the guy with the Celtics. I mean, Jalen's obviously a really close second, but Tatum's the guy. Pasta's the guy with the Bruins. The Patriots, it's going to be whoever they draft at third. Like, that guy, whether it's Jaden Daniels or Drake May, that's the guy. That's the quarterback. That's the most important piece of the organization going forward. I do think there is a world where Rafael Devers could risk losing his spot. Like, if... Now, I just want it to be both him and Casas have outstanding seasons, and this becomes like this new great Red Sox duo. I've talked about that in the past. You always have that 1-2 punch, Mookie and JD, Ortiz and Manny, right? Like, you always have that 1-2 punch, and they could be that. But if Casas has like a significantly better season than Rafi, which I don't think is out of the question. I mean, you think about it. Casas had a .367 on base percentage last year. It's better than any on base percentage Rafi's had in any single season. Now, a lot of that is the walk rate for Casas is almost at 14% last year. Rafi's career high, actually last year, good number, 9.5%, but he's never going to walk as much as Casas. But my point is, like, I want this to be a duo situation because I do think that Casas, in terms of the star power, he has a lot to offer, right? He's eccentric. He's a different type of cat. Like, you know what I mean? He's all over the place. Sunbathing, I know he doesn't do that anymore, but he's got the nails painted. He likes to talk to the media. Entertaining guy. I mean, he gets pumped when he realizes, okay, that ball's off the plate, and he'll say out or up, down. Like, he's a fun player to watch, Casas is. So I do think that he has a chance to sort of take over being the star player of the Red Sox. Now, the one thing they both need is this team needs to be relevant enough for that to actually happen. And we'll see if that happens. But I hope that Rafi has a massive season after making the comments, because I do think that was, and I know it was a while ago now, but I do think that was a sign of maturity. I think it kind of goes under the radar how good Rafael Devers has been really since he came up. I know the defense, I've talked about on multiple occasions, but I do think it goes under the radar because the team's been so bad. And the discussion around the team is not like when Mookie was here and this team was playing so well, we're talking about Mookie. When Pedroia was here, we're talking about Pedroia. When they had those great teams with Pedro and all these guys and Manny, we're talking about the team. We weren't talking about the ownership group as much. There was a time like in the early part of the last decade when that was a question again, and then they just started spending like crazy again, and we weren't talking about that anymore. So I just hope the discussion at some point get back to the Red Sox. And look, I'm not saying that the ownership group doesn't deserve this. I talked about it multiple times. I'm just pointing out the fact that I don't want that to be the discussion. I'm tired of that being the discussion. Oh, one other Red Sox note we should mention. No CJ Cron. He got released. And Alex Spear, I think, was the first that had. It's not a surprise. Like, I thought, okay, bring him into camp. This guy, 2021, hit the shit out of the ball against left-handed pitching. And he was dealing with an injury last season, but he doesn't really have any versatility. So if he didn't have like an unbelievable camp, they weren't going to keep him there because he can only play first base. Like you can't play him in the outfield. So there's really just not a lot of spots to be able to get Crone at bats. Oh, and I should mention the Ohtani story. It just keeps getting crazier. The Red Sox actually had to issue a statement to say that his interpreter never worked for them. Because it's been being written all over the place. Like, oh, he worked for the Red Sox. He never worked for the Red Sox. And then he also claimed he went to UC Riverside. He never went there. I mean, this is unbelievable. It's one of the wildest stories that we've seen in recent sports history. All right, coming up next, we'll get to a call. We'll get to an email. And we'll bring in producer extraordinaire Jamie McClone.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome back into Off the Pike. All right, we'll get to a call here. That number is 617-396-7172.
Brian, I just saw that the Jets signed Mike Williams. The Bengals signed Trent Brown. I'm sorry, on your show, it's the Bengals. I just feel like the Red Sox told us they were going to go full throttle. Jerod Mayo told us that they were going to burn cash. And here we are sitting here with another team ready to tank for this season. What happened to Boston sports ownership? The Celtics are going all in. That's great. The Red Sox are just turning this into a private equity profit machine. Bob Kraft is looking like he lucked into Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, and now we're going back to the bad old days. Am I wrong?
Okay, that's actually a great point about Robert Kraft. And I'm all for Robert Kraft takes. You know how I feel about some of the stuff that Kraft says. But that's actually a fantastic point. Like, that's a great point. I never even thought about that. We talk all the time about how, like, everybody wants to criticize Bill. Like, oh, what's he done without Brady? And I totally understand that. It was really bad after Tom left for Tampa Bay. But it's a good point. Like, what has Kraft done without Belichick? And you could say, yeah, him and Parcells, like, went to the Super Bowl, but then that relationship was ruined, right? You can blame Parcells if you want. I mean, we've talked to Ted Johnson about that, how they were upset about the fact that and Bledsoe actually mentioned on the pod, too, you're getting ready for a Super Bowl, and Parcells, like, everybody knows he's going to the Jets. Like, he's not going to be the coach anymore, so it's a distraction. But you get my point. It's like, now Kraft's on the clock. He's got nobody else to blame. Let's see what Robert Kraft does, because it was all Bill's fault. Everything was Bill's fault, and it was Bill's fault Tom left, blah, blah, blah. Let's see what Robert Kraft does, okay? And I do agree with, like, the Red Sox-Patriots comparison. We may have talked about this on the pod before, but Mayo's going out there all excited. We're burning cash, and then Kraft's like, well, hold on. Gerard, you got to walk that one back. It's like, okay, so all these years, we've been talking about the Patriots are cheap because of Bill Belichick. Right? Because Bill likes to squeeze every penny out of players. He has guys taking pay cuts. When you find out for a 10-year period that the Patriots were last in the NFL in cash, you think that's a Bill thing? No, it's a Robert Kraft thing. And sure, I'm sure Bill, because the economics background and all that, he wants to win like negotiations. Sure. But I do think that Kraft deserves a lot of blame for, I don't know, the owner spent the least amount of money in cash the past decade. So I just feel like, and you know, I've talked about this a million times. I don't want to go into complete digression here. Kraft gets off the hook for a lot of stuff. And the Red Sox, yeah, we've talked about this one, and I was just talking about it. I just feel like at this point, and I'm grateful for what the ownership group did, forever grateful. 2004 World Series, reverse the curse. 2007, that team was awesome. Even some of the teams that weren't good that they tried on, right? You think about the chicken and beer team, they tried. And then 13, they're like, you know what? This is an acceptable last place team. Let's try to put a bunch of veterans out there, right? And they won a World Series that year, and I never thought they could win a World Series. 18, and even before 18, let's trade for Chris Sale. David Price, even though it didn't work out, I know he's part of a World Series team. I think for the most part, we'd say that didn't work out for the Red Sox with all the issues they have, but they spent a ton of money on a starter, right? They went after JD Martinez. We've seen it before with this organization, and lately it doesn't feel, because they have so much else going on, that the actual baseball team is a priority. So yes, and fans are going to be pissed off. We'll see. I mean, I hope this team, not for ownership, not because of ownership, I hope this team is better for, quite frankly, selfish purposes. And like, I like a lot of players on the team. I like the manager. Like, I want this team to be good. So I hope they are. There's a lot of question marks entering the season. Okay, we'll bring in producer extraordinaire Jamie McClellan. Jamie, what's going on, man?
I'm good, Brian. I'm glad you pointed out earlier that opening day is at 10 p.m. Eastern. This is crazy.
Yeah.
Opening day, not opening night.
I know. It's not fun, man. I do remember back in the day, wasn't it like the Reds always played the first game? Like they were the first game every year? I think they were. I don't know. Somebody older would have to correct me on that. But I think the Reds, like it always used to be like, hey, this is the first game every year. But yeah. And last week, I know they're trying to grow the game. I know a lot of people are like, oh, it shouldn't be starting somewhere else. I didn't really mind that because that's really not opening day. That's just like, yeah. it's kind of like a bonus for us, right?
It's an exhibition.
Yeah, for me, I'm like waking up and it's like, oh, it's the second inning of a baseball game. I'm going to kind of watch this thing. And in the second game, I watched most of that game because it was crazy. Well, I forget what the final score was. I think it was like 13 to 11 or something along those lines. But yeah, that was why Machado hit a late home run to sort of seal that for the Padres. But
I think,
yeah, I don't know. Opening day to me. And like, here's the other thing that hurts Major League Baseball. Nobody's watching any of those games at night because the Sweet 16 is Thursday. Okay, so nobody's watching any of those games, even here locally. Like Boston has the regional, you know, Garden. You're gonna have a great, great crew there with Illinois and Iowa State. That should be an awesome game, like that. And UConn's gonna be there. I mean, knock on wood. We're recording before UConn's playing. I think I feel pretty confident UConn's gonna win. But anyway,
no, I mean they struggle to go up against any sport. Seemingly baseball, they seem to lose that one. But maybe that'll change with the rule changes and stuff. But also, last point about that was. It kind of worked out for the East Coast, those Korea games, because it was on in the morning, but it was the Padres and the Dodgers. It was on at like 2:30 in the morning for the West Coast.
Yeah, I heard they had I forget the guy's name they had on during the broadcast, the ESPN broadcast, and he made that point. I wasn't even thinking of it. I was just thinking like selfish, like I'm watching baseball, I didn't really care. And then it's like, oh yeah, that does actually really suck for the Dodgers and the Padres. But the point that they were making is like, there was a huge Dodger fan base.
Yeah.
So they wanted to put teams out that people cared about there locally, right? So that, I guess that was part of it. They didn't know that there'd be this huge scandal that'd be happening.
I just don't understand the timing of the first day of his Dodgers career. I mean, you can't draw that up. That's totally bonkers.
Imagine if whoever it is, but imagine if Otani's interpreter posted his bets and you just faded him. I mean, how rich would you be? Be the richest guy going, man.
Unlucky guy, I guess.
All right, let's get to an email. That email address is offthepike@gmail.com. What do we got, Jamie?
This is an interesting take. This is from Dan. This is regarding the Celtics. Dan writes, I have a hypothetical that I've been thinking about that I'd like to share with you and hear your thoughts. Basically, would have happened if this past offseason if we had won Game 7 against the Heat? I think we probably would have still lost to Denver, but we would have put up a better fight than Miami did. They were out of gas and all their shooters were ice cold. So let's just say that the Celtics win Game 7 against the Heat and then lose a competitive series against the Nuggets. Are we still going into this past offseason looking to shake things up like we did after losing to the Heat? Do you think we still would have parted with Marcus Smart? Personally, I think Brad Stevens would have been looking to improve, but might have been willing to work around the fringes rather than completely blow things up. So basically there's a whole level where if they had won that game, they might not have had Jrue Holiday and Kristaps Porzingis, he's saying. What do you make of that?
That's an interesting point because it's almost like, and I understand the question, but it's almost like my interpretation of what he's saying is like, by losing Game 7, it actually helped out in the long run, right? Which I do agree with because I think it's more difficult to move on from Marcus, less so with Brogdon, because Brogdon didn't really have a real connection. I know he's the sixth man of the year, but he's only here for a year, right? It's not like he had a... And by the way, that injury, I think I've mentioned this on the pod, that goes under the radar in that series too, because he couldn't shoot Brogdon, after he hurt his arm, right? Like, that was a match. And he was actually good in the playoffs for the Celtics. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if you move on from Marcus, if that's the case. I guess a lot of it, though, would have to depend on how that series went. Like, if it was the Celtics really struggled offensively, like at times they struggled against the Heat offensively, then maybe you would be looking, because they had been looking at, like, an upgrade at the big position for a while, like, and Porzingis has obviously been on the radar. So maybe you do make that move anyway, where it's like, okay, you just lost 4-2, and Denver's offense was way better than yours. And you need something different. Like, it's the same, the Celtics are losing the games the same type of ways, where it's like, They get stuck. They're stuck in the mud offensively. The shot selection is not great. We need some sort of change. And that's why I think they probably would have, even if they, because I think they would have lost to Denver too last year. They would not have been ready for that team based on how they addressed the rest of the postseason, right? But I do think they would probably still make the Porzingis trade. Now, Drew, I don't know, because the Drew situation just kind of, it kind of fell in your lap, right? Where it's like, wait, Drew Holiday is available? Okay, what's it going to cost? Robert Williams, Brogdon? And a pick or whatever it was. Okay, yeah, let's bring him in. So I don't know. The Drew one, I would say, like, if the Drew one was, like, more thought out, I would say no, they wouldn't pull off the Drew one. But the way that it sort of happened, maybe they would have. So I think they still would have made changes. I do. I think it would have been more difficult, but I still think they would have made changes.
Yeah, I think it's also predicated. I mean, he mentioned Jason Tatum's rolled ankle, and yeah, that mattered. But I don't think it's, you know, it's an assumption to say they would have won the game if Jason Tatum didn't roll his ankle, and if they hadn't won the game, it's like, well, that same thing happened. Yeah,
I do kind of agree with that, though, that because Tatum outplayed Butler 4, 5, and 6
right
after Butler was really good the first. Tatum was awesome momentum. 4, 5, and 6, and he couldn't move. Like, he really couldn't move, and we could, and look, Jalen didn't really pick him up with the turnovers, but yeah, Tatum couldn't move, so I do think they would have won that game. And, like, you know what's so aggravating about that, looking back, is I think I referenced this, I can't remember when, but, like, the shooting splits for those guys on the Heat, where it's like they were
crazy.
Like, Martin couldn't miss, and then he goes to the Nuggets series and he couldn't hit shit.
Yeah.
Oh, he turned back into the player he was. He got, like, unbelievably hot for a 7-game series, and then he just completely fell apart. I do think, though, like, the Marcus thing, now that I think about it, I think they probably came to the conclusion that we may have to move on from him because.
Yeah.
I know, like, that you didn't want to pick your battles in the regular season by having him not close and putting him on the bench. Like, you thought that could have caught, that could have been an issue, right, in the locker room. And that, like, even Ime, like, Ime had trouble not closing with Marcus. Remember, and most of the time, like, you wanted Marcus in the closing lineup when Ime was here. But remember, they won a game in the playoffs, and Marcus didn't close, and Ime praised him for, like, being a good teammate. It's like he needed the pat on the back. So I do think, like, and I referenced this earlier when I was talking about the Celtics, but I do think getting Marcus, and this is not like, it's not like I dislike Marcus, but I think he's such a big personality that you couldn't bring him back in here with Jalen, Tatum, not that Jalen and Tatum don't like him, they obviously love him, and Mazzulla. Like, I felt like those three guys needed a bigger voice in the room. And Jalen always had a voice in the room, but now he's the guy, right? Like, he's the leader on the team.
Yeah.
Tatum is more lead by example type guy. But Mazzulla, like, he has more power, right? There's not, like, pushback with Mazzulla now because Marcus isn't part of the equation. And that, like I said, I don't want people to misinterpret what I'm saying. Like, I'm not saying that Marcus is a bad guy or anything along those lines. It's just, he's been here since 2014. He was drafted in 2014. He's here for Brad's first season. Like, and it was just, it felt like he at times thought he was on, not to say that he thought he was as good as Tatum and Jalen, but he thought it was like, it's our team. It's us three.
Yeah.
When it's like, you have to take a step back, right? And especially after, and he was awesome when he won Defensive Player of the Year, but that only gave him more power, right?
No, totally. I think at the time, I was kind of ready to shake things up and was okay with the trade, but it was pretty controversial in Boston. I feel like you can't argue the results, as you pointed out earlier. Like, I feel like at this point, everyone in Celtics Nation is okay with that, with moving on from him. And yeah, it's you're allowed to love the guy, but I think, again, you can't argue with how well things have gone this year.
For sure. All right, Jamie, good stuff, man.
Thank you, Brian.
All right. All right, as always, make sure to get your voicemails in, 617-396-7172. Email your thoughts and questions to offthepike@gmail.com. Thanks to Jamie McClellan and Steve Cerruti for producing this podcast, and we'll chat in a couple of days. Must be 21 plus and present in select states. FanDuel is offering online sports wagering in Kansas under an agreement with Kansas Star Casino, LLC. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit FanDuel.com/RG in Colorado, Iowa, Michigan, New Jersey, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, and Vermont. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP or text NEXTSTEP to 53342 in Arizona, 1-888-789-7777, or visit ccpg.org/chat in Connecticut, 1-800-9-WITH-IT in Indiana, 1-800-522-4700, or visit ksgamblinghelp.com in Kansas, 1-877-770-STOP in Louisiana, visit mdgamblinghelp.org in Maryland, visit 1800gambler.net in West Virginia, or call 1-800-522-4700 in Wyoming. Hope is here. Visit gamblinghelplinema.org or call 800-327-5050 for 24/7 support in Massachusetts, or call 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY in New York.